بسم الله، الحمد لله، والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. أما بعد، what did we talk about yesterday? What about water particularly? طهور طاهر النجس, right? Okay. Who can define to me what is طهور water? Guy in the green shirt. What is tahur water? Pure water that doesn't purify others? Now look again. Tahur. Yeah. So it is pure in and of itself and it purifies other things, right? Okay. What is tahir water? Yaqi, you got confused with tahir. What is tahir water? Yeah. Okay, when does tahur water become tahir? Or how do you get tahir water? What's the criterion or difference? Yeah. No longer water, exactly. When you add a pure substance, you have to make sure you understand, when you add a pure substance to water. In other words, pure meaning, remember, pure meaning Islamically pure. In other words, it's not najis. Everything that is non-najis is pure. We define some najasat, right? Remember we did some najis. Everything that's not najis is pure. So you add a pure substance to tahur water until it changes and it becomes tahir water. How do you get najis water? For what is the definition of najis? Obviously it's pure, it's impure in and of itself and it cannot purify. How do you get from tahur to najis? No, you have to be very careful how you define it. Don't just say urine. What is the point? What is when you add what? The moderator? Okay. When you? No. That is? Najis, exactly. When you add a najis, an impure substance, you have to, don't just give one example of urine, because then what if you add something else, you see? You have to give it, the definition has to be very careful. When you add an impure substance to tahur water, okay, when you add an impure substance until one or more than one of three characteristics change, it's smell or color or taste. And then it becomes from tahur to najis, okay? And we said that if you have a small amount of water and you add an impure substance which doesn't change the color, taste, or smell, is it allowed to do wudu with that water? It's preferred not to. It's discouraged to do wudu with that type of water. But if you do wudu, then your wudu is acceptable, okay? Now, did we define tahara yesterday? I'm wondering, did we define tahara when we started? Because we're doing the book of tahara. I don't think we defined tahara. Huh? Okay, tahara is to is the removal of impurities and impurities, both physical and, if you like, spiritual. Okay, the removal of impurities, both physical and spiritual. By physical, obviously, it's understood what we mean by tahara. But first of all, what is tahara? Tahara is the chapter title we're doing right now. This is the Kitab al-Tahara, the book of tahara, the book of purification. Okay, so tahara is defined to be the removal of purities, both physical and spiritual. What do we mean by physical impurities? Obviously, for example, feces, urine, stool, everything like this, okay? Or blood, or a vomit, or something like this, okay? What do we mean by spiritual impurities? Making wudu, for example. For example, you went to the restroom, you cleansed yourself, you're clean now. But can you pray? Can you pray without doing wudu yet? No. So then, when you do wudu, you're doing tahara. So then this is a removal of a spiritual impurity. Spiritually, you're not in a state to pray yet. Okay? So therefore, when you do wudu, you become purified, even though physically you are pure. Physically, you've cleansed yourself and everything. Okay? So then this is how we define tahara. I forgot to define that yesterday. Now, after the book of water, what do you think the next obvious topic is going to be? Who's very intelligent and can figure out this? There's one thing before wudu. Be logical. We've just defined water now. What are we going to do with this water? It gets after a while. There's one chapter left, though, in between. Who can guess? Remember, we're thinking very practical now. No, Husayn gets even after wudu. Believe it or not, it's the chapter known as the chapter of... No, we already did the passive water. No, utensils. Utensils, yeah, pots and pans. Why are we talking about utensils? Can anyone guess the relationship? Exactly. Well, how are we going to get this water? See, the ulama, they go very logically. The scholars of fiqh, they went very logically, one by one. Okay? First, they define the basis of purification, which is water. And so we understood that we can only purify ourselves with water. Which, for example, how does that become practical now? For example, if a najis falls on your clothes, okay, and you send it to the dry cleaners, it's not going to become Islamically purified. Okay? You understand this point? Because it wasn't purified with water. From what I understand, dry cleaners don't use water, right? Yeah, they use, you know, alcohol or something. They don't use water, okay? So if you, so before you send it to dry cleaners, make sure you clean the najis off yourself. Either you send it to the real laundry, right? Or you send it to the dry cleaners, then you take it back, you wash it with water, the point that was najis, okay? So this is a practical benefit, so you start off with water. Now after water, you move on to, how are you going to use this water? We need containers, you know? We need, what are we going to put this water in? Okay? So we have to discuss which containers are allowed and which are not allowed. Okay, we're going to go over this briefly because it's not as practical as it was in the past because we just turned the tap on. We use the water without any containers. In the good old days, they didn't have any taps. Okay, so they had to have containers and they would pour it. Now, every single utensil and container is allowed. Every single container that is tahir in and of itself is allowed, even if it is expensive. Tahir, we already defined what tahir means. It's pure in and of itself, but it does not purify other things. Even if it is expensive, you can use a multi-million dollar container, it doesn't matter. As long as it is not made out of gold or silver. Gold or silver utensils are not allowed, they are forbidden. This is because the Prophet ﷺ said, do not drink or eat from utensils of gold and silver. Okay? For whoever does it in this world, then he will be forbidden from it in the Akhirah. Because you know, in the Jannah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give us, inshaAllah, plates and utensils of gold and silver. So the Prophet ﷺ said, whoever uses gold and silver in this world, then he will be forbidden from it in the Akhirah. So you're not allowed to use utensils of gold and silver. Now, the question that arises, obviously, is gold-plated and silver-plated. How about this? Because it's something which is very practical in our times. Now, the scholars have differed about these type of utensils. I don't think there's any difference about gold and silver. I think that's pretty much the majority of scholars say that. But as for gold plating and silver plating, the utensils that we have and the vessels that we have, okay, the scholars have differed about that. Some of them, they say, prohibited, both of them, okay? Some say it's allowed only when you use silver, a slight amount of silver. And this is based on a hadith of the Prophet ﷺ in which Aisha, or rather Anas, he said that one of the Prophet's drinking vessels, the vessels of those times were different from ours, I mean, they were constructed and carved out, you know. One of them, they broke, they had a hole in them. So it was filled, the gap was filled with a small amount of silver. Okay, so, and this hadith is reported in Bukhari. So now the people, now the ulama, they say, okay, well, since the Prophet ﷺ filled his little amount of vessel with silver and he allowed it and he drank from it, then this means that if we use a little amount of silver, it's allowed. Okay, and Allahu A'lam, this might perhaps be the correct opinion, Allahu A'lam, is that silver-plated utensils, right, they might be allowed. But for sure, it's better to avoid it, because some ulama say it's haram, both of them, silver and gold-plated. And some made an exception for silver-plated and not for gold-plated. They said it's allowed for silver and not allowed for gold, because of this hadith. And when we say silver-plated, obviously we understand, silver-plating is a very small amount of silver. It's literally, you know, a layer of molecules, right? Am I correct? It's a layer of molecules. Or two layers of molecule, is very little amount of silver is placed on the actual utensil. So that's why some scholars made an exception to it. But for sure, it's better to avoid it. It's more pious and, you know, it's safer to avoid even silver plated utensils. Okay, likewise, the utensils of the kuffar, they are pure unless we know for a fact that there was something najis in them. So when we go to a restaurant, for example, a kafir restaurant, those utensils, we don't have to ask about them. We're allowed to eat and drink, and even if we have to do wudu from one of their utensils, suppose that they had a bucket or something, we're allowed to do it as long as we know that, or as long as we do not know that there was a najis in them. Because we don't have to ask what was in this container before, no. If we know for a fact that there was some type of najis, meaning pork, or alcohol or something, in that case we have to wash that utensil before we use it. Otherwise, in general, the utensils of the kuffar are allowed to use. Like we said, unless we know for a fact that there was a najis before them. Okay? Okay, one last thing before we get to the next chapter. How about leather? And obviously, when we're talking about wudu here, we're talking about containers of water. This automatically implies wearing it and, you know, using it and benefiting from it. Automatically, it's implied. If you're allowed to benefit from wudu, you're obviously allowed to benefit in other characteristics. Now, concerning leather, there's a number of different opinions, actually 6 or 7 opinions, if I'm not mistaken, okay? But the correct opinion, in my opinion, Every one of you, like I said, this fiqh class, you're free to go and research and, you know, disagree if you're qualified to do so after ulama. But in my humble opinion, the correct opinion regarding leather is that the leather of those animals is allowed, which you are allowed to eat. Okay, this is one of the major opinions of this cause, and the one that I also think is a correct opinion. Only those animals that you're allowed to eat, you can use their leather. Any animal that you're forbidden from eating, you are not allowed to use this leather. You're not allowed to wear it, you're not allowed to use it, anything. Okay, so for example, cow leather, okay, sheep leather, okay, these are all allowed to use. Pig leather, dog, all of this is haram for you to use. Likewise, leopard skins, the animals that you cannot eat, you are not allowed to benefit and use their leather. In other words, you cannot use wudu from their utensils. You remember, in the old days, they would make utensils and leather and containers out of leather too. In our times, it's a bit rare. So we don't use it, but we wear it more now. Okay? In the end, most likely. Yes. On the floor? No, specifically regards to cheetahs and leopards, there is a hadith that the angels don't accompany this type of leather, specifically with regards to those type of animals. Okay. As for placing it on the floor, I'm gonna have to ask Allahu A'lam, you know, because you're not using it, so I'm gonna have to ask. I don't know that. But the point is, you cannot use it directly. You cannot use those type of leather directly that is najis. For example, pigskin, you cannot obviously buy shoes made out of pigskin, watches or anything, okay? You should only buy stuff which is made, if you want to buy leather, out of cow skin or sheep skin or any animal that is halal to eat, okay? Those animals that are not halal to eat, right, you cannot tan their leather and use and benefit from it. This is because the Prophet ﷺ said that whatever leather or whatever skin has been tanned becomes pure. Whatever skin, animal skin, when you tan it, it becomes pure. Because you know that animals, dead animals, they are considered najis. When you pass by a sheep carcass or any carcass, it's considered najis. You cannot eat from that carcass, you cannot benefit from it at all. But the Prophet made an exception for the skin, the leather. He said, as when you tan that leather, then it becomes pure. So obviously you're going to tan the leather of those animals that you have to eat. For example, cows and sheep and goats and others. Okay, so this type of leather is allowed. That finishes the chapter of Aniyah, the chapter of utensils. You know, very simple, very easy chapter, and we glossed over it because it's not that practical in our times. Okay. The next chapter we're going to come to, now we get to, which chapter? Someone can guess? Wudu, what comes before wudu? You're going to have to break your wudu to get to wudu. Huh? So, the chapter of the etiquettes of the restroom. Okay? The chapter of the etiquettes of the restroom. Now, obviously, the first thing which everyone knows is human nature is that when you need to use the restroom, you should conceal yourself, okay? You should conceal yourself. You should go to a place where others cannot see you. And if you're in a place like this, you go to the restroom. If you're in an empty field, you should go behind something which, you know, an object or something that will cover you up, okay? Behind a bush, behind a tree. Obviously, this is common sense and decency. Because the Prophet ﷺ, in one hadith, Anas said that when the Prophet ﷺ wanted to use the restroom, he would go a far, far distance so that no one could see him. And then he would use it. Okay, so this is part of the adab, is that you conceal yourself if you're in the open. If you're using these restrooms, obviously you're concealed anyway. Okay. Also, you should say, before entering the restroom, you should say, Bismillah, Allahumma inni a'udhu bika min al-khubuthi wal-khaba'ith. Bismillah, Allahumma inni a'udhu bika min al-khubuthi wal-khaba'ith. Which means, obviously, Bismillah, I seek your refuge, Allah, from the khubuth and khaba'ith, the male and the female jinns. As you know, jinns are dirty creatures. They like to remain in very dirty places. Okay? So therefore, they love to live in restrooms. They love to live in toilets. They love to live in those types of places. So therefore, the Prophet, when he said, when you enter the restroom, you make the du'a to seek refuge from the evil of the male and female jinns. And also, he said that when a person says Bismillah, it will act as a barrier between him, between his private parts, between the shaitan seeing his nakedness, basically. So that, because when you take your clothes off, then obviously men will not see you because you're in the restroom, but the angels can see you. So the Prophet said, or not angels, excuse me, they're not the jinns. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, when you say Bismillah, it acts like a shield or a barrier between you and the jinn, so they cannot see you. So who amongst us doesn't want to have this type of privacy? Okay, so you should say then Bismillah, and then you seek Allah's refuge from the male and female jinns, because they inhabit the restrooms more than they inhabit other places. And he should obviously enter with his, which foot? left foot. Okay? He should enter the restroom with his left foot, and when he enters the masjid or his house, he should enter with his right foot. This is everyone knows this stuff. When you exit the restroom, you should say Ghufranaka. Ghufranaka. I seek your refuge, or I seek your mercy, Allah. And another narration, Alhamdulillah, الذي أذهب عنا الأذى وعافاني. Or you can just write Ghufranak. Now, why are you saying Ghufranak at this time? Some of the scholars have made a type of wisdom or a hikmah. Is that when you leave the restroom, you obviously leave your filth behind. You leave your filth and your najas behind you. Likewise, when you exit the restroom, this should remind you of seeking forgiveness of Allah so that you can leave your spiritual filthiness. In other words, your sins behind you also. So you say, Ghufranaka, I seek your refuge. In other words, just like I have left behind my physical impurities, O Allah, forgive me of my spiritual impurities. Okay, so some of the scholars have said that this is one of the reasons why you should say, Ghufranaka. Okay, while using the restroom, it is prohibited from facing the Qibla or turning your back to the Qibla. Okay, it is prohibited from facing the Qibla or turning your back to the Qibla. This is because the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said that when one of you uses the restroom, then he should not turn to the Qibla or turn his back towards the Qibla. Face the Qibla or turn his back to the Qibla. Okay? So when you use the restroom, you cannot turn your face towards the Qibla or turn your back. This is obviously out of respect for the Qibla. Out of respect for the direction of the Qibla. Because obviously, when you use the restroom, you're using it in the direction of the Qibla. This is a type of disrespect for this direction. And for example, to aid what I'm saying, there's a hadith in which the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, whoever spits in the direction of the Qibla, spitting even, whoever spits in the direction of the Qibla, on the Day of Judgment, he will find that spit in front of his eyes. Okay? Because it's a type of disrespect to do these type of things facing the Qibla. Therefore, when you go to the restroom, you should turn away from the Qibla. However, there is one exception to this rule, and that is when there is a barrier between you and the Qibla. So, for example, if you're in an open field, in this case, you have to be careful. Which way is the Qibla? Which way can I face? Can I not face? When you're in a closed field, such as the restrooms of today, then you don't have to even worry about it. You don't have to think, am I facing the Qibla or not? Because there's a barrier right between you and the Qibla. So you don't have to worry about that. Okay? This is based on the hadith of Ibn Umar, that he climbed on top of the Prophet's house. Okay? In those days, the houses were very small, so he just climbed on top of them. And he said, I saw the Prophet ﷺ from far away, obviously, using the restroom, his back was towards the Qibla. But between him and the Qibla was the house. Okay? So this shows you then that if there is a barrier between you and the Qibla, meaning a direct barrier, not like 1,000 miles away I see a skyscraper, no. I mean a direct barrier right between you where you're sitting or where you're using the restroom, you have, for example, a wall, or like in our modern day restrooms, you have walls everywhere. In this case, you don't have to worry about which direction the Qibla is. Ask it towards the end, inshallah. We can finish. Yeah. Now, forest, I mean, woodland perhaps is better to avoid the Qibla. You know, because what we mean by barrier is like a physical object or something, you know, not a bunch of trees or something. Okay, obviously it is encouraged, or, you know, not to take one's clothes off until the last minute. And this is obviously due to the fact that someone might see you. And this you have to take into account. When they used to go to the restroom in the old times, they would go to a place outside. There wouldn't be structures like this, okay? So you shouldn't take your clothes off until you're ready to use the restroom at the last minute, so that people don't see you or your aura. Likewise, in our modern times, until we close the door and we lock it behind us, you know? Okay, obviously, many people, they always ask the question about, before we get there, you shouldn't urinate or defecate in places that are used by people. In other words, shelters, you know, paths, roadways, under trees that are used by people as paths. The Prophet ﷺ said, beware or be careful of two places that are cursed. Okay? And when he was asked, what are these two places? He said, those people that defecate or urinate in the shade that people use or in the path that they use. So when a person passes by a path and he sees the urine or the feces, he's going to curse the person. He said, may Allah curse the one who did this. He's causing discomfort and making it disgusting to use this path. So the Prophet ﷺ said, avoid the two places that people will curse. In other words, avoid doing these things at places where people are going to cause harm and discomfort to them. Okay? And obviously this is more practical when we didn't have structured toilets or restrooms. Likewise, you should avoid graveyards of Muslims and, you know, places that are going to cause harm even to the dead. And like we said, shade trees, the shade of the trees that is used, and other things like this. Also, it is disliked to remain in the restroom for a long time. This for many reasons. First, it's a disgusting place. It's a disgusting place. That's where you use our najis comes out, you know. And, you know, it's even biologically, I mean, it's a very dirty place, germs are there and stuff. Likewise, spiritually, there are a lot of jinns there. You know, we should spend as minimum amount of time as possible. Which also implies, by the way, that this culture that is prevalent in our country, in the West, in America in particular, of having magazines, of having even a television in the restroom, this is not a culture of the Muslims. They don't go to the restroom to read. They don't go to the restroom to watch TV or have magazines. No, you go there and you stay there as minimum as you need to. Get out of there as fast as possible because it's a dirty place, physically and spiritually. Okay, so we don't enjoy our time in the restroom unlike the Christians and the West do. They have their magazine right next to the toilet. Some even have a VCR and a TV. No, we don't have these type of things. Okay, the Muslims, they have a higher culture than this. Okay, the restroom is a place you go to do your stuff and you get out. That's it. You don't stay there for a long time. Likewise, concerning how to cleanse oneself after using the restroom. When it comes to the urine, obviously the Prophet ﷺ forbade touching one's private parts, both front and back, with the right hand. Okay, he forbade it. So it is haram to touch your private parts with your right hand. Only with your left hand can you touch your private parts. Okay, so the person should be careful, especially with males, that the urine does not splatter back on him. So he should be careful where he urinates. This is because the Prophet ﷺ said that most of the punishment of the grave is due to urine. Most of the punishment of the grave is due to urine. Because when you urinate and it splashes back on you, and then you offer your prayers, this is you offering your prayer in najis. Okay? It splashes back on your clothes or yourself or something. It splashes back and you're offering your prayer in najis. So obviously your prayer is not going to be accepted. And you're going to be punished for those points of urine that dropped on you. Okay? So you have to be very careful that the urine does not splash back on you. So you have to, like the scholars in the old days, they would say, you should choose a place for your urine. Make sure the sand is not hard, that doesn't... So in our times, we just use common sense, you know. It's just common sense. Likewise, when we finish, we should make sure that there is no urine left in our private parts. So, for example, with males, they should make sure that they shake it a little bit. They make sure that there is no urine left. Because if you put back your undergarments, okay, and there's still something left, it's going to exit and dirty your undergarments, okay? So you should make sure that there's nothing left. And then... You're allowed, there are three ways of washing oneself, both front and back. You're allowed to wash with dry substances only, you're allowed to wash with water only, and you're allowed to combine with water and dry substances. Okay? So, with dry substances, for example, rocks and sand, or toilet paper in our times, it's all the same thing. Okay? You're allowed to wash yourself with that. When it comes to the urine, then you just wipe yourself until there is no traces left of urine. Okay? And when it comes to the feces, or washing yourself from stool, then you have to wash yourself an odd number of times, because the Prophet said when you wash yourself, then wash yourself an odd number of times, and you have to wash yourself at least three times. At least three times. This is because it is well known that underneath three times, you're not going to be able to cleanse that point, especially if you're washing with a dry substance. So at least three times with three different papers, you should wash yourself, make sure that there's nothing left. When I say at least three, it means that if you have to go more than this, you have to go more than this. And the scholars, the criterion they give is that when the paper, or when, for example, our times toilet paper, when it is removed without having any traces of feces on it, this is the minimum, okay? So that when you wipe yourself once, two, three, four, five times, six times, and you find that there's no traces left, okay, then you just wipe yourself one more time, seven, to make it odd. That's it then. Okay, the point is though that there must be no traces of stool left on your body. And that is the minimum requirement. So if you can do it in three times, fine. If you need to do it more, do it as many times as need be. And the criterion or the break-off point is when you can remove the piece of paper or whatever you're wiping yourself with and it has no stool or no signs left on it. This is the minimum. And after that, you make it an odd number and you finish with that. Likewise, you're not allowed to use something that is respected as toilet paper. For example, by respect, obviously, astaghfirullah, we're not referring to the Quran. We're talking about even like written paper. Okay, because something which is respected. Why is that? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala describes mankind that He has taught him the art of writing. So this is a great blessing, the art of writing. You know, so we're not allowed to use paper that is respected, that has written things on it. Forget, obviously, the Quran says this is kufr if someone does it. This is kufr, this is blasphemy. And he has exited the fold of Islam if he does this consciously. We're talking about stuff that is respected. For example, even money, for example. Even money. You're not allowed to wipe yourself with money because it is something that is respected. You need it to use for your daily lives. Okay? So you can only use stuff which is not considered respected, like toilet paper, like sand. Then exit and dirty your undergarments. Okay? So you wash yourself until, I said the front part you should wash, you're allowed comes dry, the back part until there are no traces left. This is if you use dry substances. If you use water And water is better than that. Water is better than using shirk. Again, what is? If you use water, then you with dry stuff until there are no traces left. Both times the criterion is the same. Okay? But using water is preferred to using by substances. This is because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala praises the people of the Masjid of Quba, which is in Medina. So the Prophet asked them, why do I praise you? They said, we don't know anything special we do, except that when we go to the restroom, we make sure that we wipe ourselves or we wash ourselves with water, not just with dry substances. Okay? So Allah describes them as being pure. Allah describes the people of Quba as being pure. So when they were asked, why did Allah describe you like this? They said that, well, the only thing is that we learned from the Jews, we learned this act from the Jews, and when we go to the restroom, we'll wipe ourselves with water. So it is preferred to wipe yourself with water. But if you don't, it's fine. And this is something many Muslims, they don't know. You are allowed to wipe yourself with toilet paper, and it is absolutely fine. Your prayer is acceptable. You have fulfilled the requirement. Okay, many Muslims, they don't know this. And I knew Muslims, they would put themselves in great hardship in order to do this. But they didn't know that you're allowed to wipe yourself with toilet paper. Likewise, if you combine both, this is even better. If you first use some toilet paper and then you use water, then this is even better. And this is also allowed. The scholars say that, especially with regard to feces, you don't have to make the place where the feces comes out of, in other words, the anus, you don't have to make that purified, because that will never be pure. That will always have remained some small traces. But the point is, you have to make sure that it doesn't spread anywhere else. Okay? So scholars, they say that particular place in and of itself, because that's where the najis comes out of, okay, it can never totally be pure. But you're worried about the side of it, in front of it, behind it. Make sure that it doesn't spread to your clothes. This is what you have to be careful of. So don't go to over extremes in, you know, trying to wash the actual place where the najis comes out of, because you will never be able to totally and completely wash the najis. Obviously, I think everyone knows that the air or the wind that a person expels is not najis. So if it touches your clothes, you don't have to wash that. I mean, everyone knows that. The air itself is not najis. Okay? The wind that a person expels, this is not najis. What is left with regards to washing oneself? Yes, we mentioned yesterday that if a male person has pre-seminal fluid, he must wash his entire penis from tip to the back of it, all of it. Okay, because the Prophet has commanded him this. Whereas if it's only urine, he only has to wash the tip of it. Okay, so that the brother should realize that every time some pre-seminal fluid comes out, you have to wash the entire private part, not just the tip of it. Also, you have to throw some water on the clothes that were affected by it, unless you change your clothes, in which case you just have to wash those. But if the clothes that were affected, the undergarments, you have to just sprinkle some water on it. You don't have to take it out and wipe it, or you just sprinkle some, throw some water on it, that it will dissolve and disappear. Likewise, when you enter the restroom, you should make sure that you don't have anything holy on you, like Quran, or like, you know, some people, they like to wear chains with Allah in the middle. This is not good to wear. But if you are wearing it, you should not, or like a t-shirt, even worse to wear a t-shirt with, you know, has Allah and His Messenger's name. I wouldn't recommend it anyway, you know, I mean, it's not a very good way of da'wah in my opinion. And, because when you go to the bathroom, what are you going to do? You're going to take your shirt off every time you go to the bathroom, if it has Allah or His Messenger's name on it. But you're not allowed to enter the bathroom or the restroom, these type of things on it. Because obviously, they should be shown some respect. Okay, and proof of this is a slightly weak hadith in the Prophet ﷺ. He used to wear a ring which says La ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah. Or no, sorry, it just said Muhammadur Rasulullah. Every time we go to the restroom, we take it off. This hadith is slightly weak, but the point is, the principle is correct. Is that when you go to the restroom, you make sure that you're not wearing, or you don't have anything that is holy on it. Also, you're not allowed to use. We mentioned that you're not allowed to use holy or pious objects, not holy, but respected objects to cleanse yourself. You're also not allowed to use animal feces, which is because obviously it's going to be impure anyway. You have to realize back in those days, one of the things that was scattered all over the desert was camel feces. Okay, so one of the prohibitions is you're not allowed to use animal feces, even though those feces might be pure in of itself. Like we mentioned, goat and cows and stuff, their urine and stool is pure. It's not najis. But you cannot, it does not purify other things. So you cannot use their najis. You cannot use their stool to purify yourself. Likewise, you're not allowed to use bones of animals. Why is that? Does anyone know the reason? That's because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that the food, the jinns will be from these bones. Our brothers of the jinn, our Muslim jinn. You know, these are Muslims and Catholics, okay? So the Muslim jinn, they will eat the used bone that we leave behind. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will provide, Allah knows what type of food, some type of meat or some on those things that the jinn will eat. So we don't want to ruin for our Muslim brothers that type of food. So obviously, just like we cannot use our food, we cannot use bread and butter and these type of stuff to cleanse ourselves, obviously. Likewise, we should not defile and ruin the food of the jinns. And the food of the jinns is the bones that are left behind by, that we eat, that are left behind of the ants. So we're not allowed to use those type of bones. Tayyib, I think we've covered everything when it comes to the restroom. Let me just quickly check. Good question. Standing and urinating. We haven't finished the lecture, don't worry, we have time. Just the chapter talking about standing and urinating. For men, obviously. The many brothers ask, can I urinate while standing? I mean, go to the urinals here. Well, firstly, with regards to the urinals here, I would say no, because your awra is not protected. Your private parts are not protected. Okay. The men, they just urinate in one in front of each other all together, and there is no privacy there. But the question arises, can I urinate in a private area? For example, go to the restroom, lock the door behind me, and then can I urinate standing? And this is especially applicable when the place is very dirty. Like, for example, you're stopping at a stop-go or something on the way, and it's very dirty. You don't want to sit down on that thing. Okay. So can I urinate while standing? Yes, you can, as long as two conditions are met. Firstly, no one can see you, because obviously when you're standing, it's not like when you're sitting, you're exposed, okay? Firstly, you're not doing it public, no one can see you, which is why the urinals, I would say no, okay? Secondly, you make sure that the urine doesn't splatter back on you, because remember, when you're standing up, there's much more chances that the urine will splatter back on you, okay? So you have to make sure and be careful that the urine does not splatter back on you with these two conditions, okay? So, if these two conditions are met, then in that case, it's allowed to urinate while standing. The proof for this is that Abu Huraira narrates that the Prophet ﷺ, when he went to the outskirts of the city, and there was a junkyard there. There was a junkyard, like people would throw their stuff there. So he urinated while standing. He urinated while standing. The scholars say the reason he did that is because it's a very dirty place, so you can't lower yourself in that area. You cannot sit down in that area. So because of that, he urinated while standing. And Aisha says in the exact opposite hadith, she said, whoever tells you that the Prophet urinated while standing, he lied, because he never urinated while standing. So how do we reconcile these two hadith? Exactly. Regular times, the Prophet would always sit down. And so Aisha never saw him stand up. Aisha never saw him stand up, because whenever Aisha saw him would be inside home, right? So she never saw him stand up. So she says, whoever tells you the Prophet is muted while standing, he's mistaken, not lying, but he's mistaken. Abu Huraira, on the other hand, he says the exact opposite. He says, I saw the Prophet muted while standing. There is no contradiction. Aisha is speaking from her knowledge, and Abu Huraira is speaking from his knowledge. And Abu Huraira gives us a reason too, because he accompanied the Prophet outside the city. Aisha didn't. He accompanied the Prophet outside the city to the junkyard, or that dirty place, so he urinated while standing. So this shows you, when you combine these two reports, shows you that it's preferred, it's encouraged to urinate while sitting down. This is because, obviously, the urine will not splatter as much, also your awra is protected more. However, if you have to urinate while standing, it's allowed to. But I would say urinals, no, because of the awra reason. If there is no awra problem, if, for example, there's a nice cover, which is not really true in America, because they have very short covers, you know, and the men can see you, and it's obviously the kuffar, they don't have any sense of modesty, so they don't mind looking at their awra, the men looking at the men's awra, and the women looking at the women's awra. We have the sense of modesty. So if you have to use urinate standing up, make sure that your awra is not seen by other people, and that the urine doesn't splatter back on you. Okay. Yeah, that hadith firstly, it occurred in the dark. It was, I think, before Fajr, okay? Also, the companion stood behind him with his back to the Prophet, so he didn't see him. Because you have to hide yourself, you don't have to show your awra. So if you're in a place where people are not going to see you, even though they might be, you know, a few meters, a few feet away, but they're not going to see you, that's fine, okay? The point is you have to hide your awra. Okay, after this comes the chapter of the siwak or the miswak. And just quickly, the miswak, because everyone knows it's a wooden stick at that people would use in the olden days to, you know, make their mouth feel fresh and good. This is sunnah at all times. The miswak is sunnah at all times, in particular before the wudu, after wudu, and before the prayers. Okay? And at all times, the Prophet would always do miswak. He would love it a lot, you know. Now obviously the question arises, does the modern day toothpaste double for the miswak? The answer is yes and no. In a way it does, in a way it doesn't, you know. I mean, it serves some purpose in that it makes your mouth feel good and fresh and everything. But at the same time, the miswak has certain medicinal benefits which have been proven by modern science. And even if they haven't, we don't care. Prophet did it. And the sunnah is to use The sunnah is to use the miswak all the time. So if the brothers have a miswak, which is difficult to get in this country, but still, you know, I mean, it is available once in a while, you see it sold here. The brothers and the sisters both, they're encouraged to use the miswak as often as possible. After this comes the sunan of the fitra, or the, I'll translate this, personal hygiene, okay? So again, the scholars of fiqh, they come from a very logical basis that you've gone to the restroom. Suppose it's the first time in your life you've gone to the restroom. Well, suppose you became Muslim, what should you do right now? Okay? You just became Muslim, what should you do? There are a number of things that you should do. Okay? First thing is, well, three things all in once. Shave the pubic hair. Okay? And shave the underarm hair. And quite as cut the nails. Shave the pubic hair. Shave the underarm hair, or to be more accurate, pluck the underarm hair, because in the old, good old days, that's what they would do. Okay, they would actually physically pluck. But in our times, we don't have to resort to that. Those measures, I don't think we have the guts to do so either, you know. We can just use the shaving cream and shave it. But the point is, once every 40 days, the Prophet said, or the Anas ibn Malik said that the Prophet gave us 40 days to do these things. Every 40 days, we have to do it, the brothers and the sisters. Shave the pubic hair, which is front and back, okay? And if you don't shave it, I mean, the cream does the same job. The point is, you have to remove that hair, okay? And shave the underarm hair and trim your nails. Okay, you have to do this maximum once every 40 days. Minimum, excuse me, once every 40 days, okay? If you don't do it for more than 40 days, you are sinful. Every 40 days comes by, you have to do all of these three things, okay? Shave both the underarm hair and the pubic hair and trim your nails. With regard to circumcision, okay. Circumcision is again a big ikhtilaf. Is it only sunnah, or is it wajib, or is it, you know, big ikhtilaf? But the correct opinion, again, in my opinion, and also according to some of the Hanbalis, is that it is obligatory for men to circumcise themselves. It is encouraged or allowed for women to circumcise themselves, okay. But it is obligatory for men to circumcise themselves unless the man fears a great danger, like or something, like a person converts when he's like, you know, maybe 67 years old. He fears he's not going to be able to undergo the pain or the surgery or everything. In this case, perhaps there's an excuse for him. But in general, it is obligatory for men to circumcise, and it is allowed for women to circumcise. For method's sake, the circumcision of the woman is not the circumcision that is known in Sudan and these countries in Africa. Okay, it is not this type of circumcision. This type of circumcision is called mutilation in Islam, and that is haram. Okay, the circumcision of women is something different, and since no one here is going to do it, there's no point in getting explicit of it. You know, but the point is, it's allowed for women, and it's maybe encouraged, but it's different from what is known in Sudan and these countries. That's the point. Okay, so whenever someone comes and tells you this type of stuff, you tell them that those practices have nothing to do with Islam or the Muslims. The practices that are being practiced in Africa, they have nothing to do with Islam or the Muslims. This is not a part of our culture or our religion. But for men, everyone knows what circumcision is, and it is obligatory according to the correct opinion. This is because of the hadith reported by Abu Dawood, in which a person came to the Prophet ﷺ having accepted Islam, and the Prophet ﷺ told him, cut your hair, jahiliyyah. His hair was in the fashion of the jahiliyyah. Okay, and this shows you that hairstyle should not be you know, changing with the flow, as I say. Just have a normal hairstyle. Shouldn't be the latest crew cutter. I mean, it shouldn't be the latest line. You shouldn't have to imitate the kuffar in order to look good. So the Prophet said, remove your hair of jahiliyyah times, okay? And ikhtatin, or circumcise yourself. Like with Ibrahim, at what age did he circumcise himself? Huh? It's like 80 years old or 90 years old, I forgot. 80? Ikhtatin, 8 years old, yes. He used an axe to circumcise himself. This shows you the dedication that Ibrahim had. When the command came down to circumcise, the instrument that he had was an axe. So he circumcised using an axe. Yes. And this shows you his dedication. I mean, how many of us could do that? Huh? No atheist either. Yeah. But this also shows you the obligatory nature of circumcision, that Ibrahim would do this act when he's 80 years old, you know, with an axe in such circumstances. It shows you the obligation of circumcision. Obviously, circumcision is allowed any time, but it's preferred to do it at a young age. Why? Because the child will not remember the pain or know the pain. Okay, it's preferred to have your child circumcised at a young age. You know, because obviously, when a person grows up, it's going to be more difficult for to get circumcised. Okay. These are not authentic, as far as I remember, having it done on a specific day. Not authentic. But if you do it on the seventh day, it's fine. you don't want to 7 days, fine. Likewise, okay, with regards to the beard and the mustache, the Prophet ﷺ commanded the men to grow their beards and to trim their mustaches, you know. And this is a command of the Prophet ﷺ, and according to the vast majority of scholars, it is obligatory to grow the beard. And in fact, I don't know of any difference between amongst the scholars of the past. Only some of the scholars of our times have said it's sunnah. But in reality, the four madhahibs and the scholars of the past and the salaf, it was unanimous that the men, they have to grow their beards and trim their mustaches, or shave their mustaches, allowed. The mustache is either trimmed or totally shaved. It's both are allowed. Okay, but the beard, it must be grown. The beard must be grown. This is according, like I said, to the vast, vast, vast majority of scholars, it is obligatory to grow the beard, not just sunnah. I think we finished with the personal hygiene. Any points left? I don't think so. Okay, we move on now to, obviously we've broken our wudu, we've used the restroom, we've done our hygiene. Now what's left? Wudu, finally. Okay, now we get to wudu. Okay, by the way, you do realize I'm going at a very fast pace here. Why? Because I want to cover a lot of topics. I want you to realize that these things exist, opinions exist. Try to start practicing them as soon as you can. And then inshallah, you'll have the rest of your life to continue your study of fiqh. You know? I mean, I don't want to go into different opinions. For example, with regards to circumcision, there's like four or five opinions. There's obligatory men, obligatory for women, obligatory for men, sunnah for women, sunnah for men, sunnah. There's so many. I'm not going into those opinions, neither the evidences. I'm telling you what is, in my humble opinion, after a little bit of research and a small student of knowledge that I am, is the correct opinion. And also, according to the, like we said, the Hanbalis, which is going over quickly. After you become more knowledgeable, after you have more time, go and read more and make your decisions. Tayyib, we get now to the chapter of wudu. No, we haven't done ghusl yet. We're going wudu one by one. We haven't done ghusl yet. Okay. We've done wudu. Okay. First thing with regards to wudu, we have to realize that the primary verse in the Quran which deals with wudu is which verse? 5-6? Very good, 5-6. Surah Ma'idah, verse 6. Ya ayyuhalladhina, I want you all to write this verse down, in the sense, write it down and write it up in your notes. Because why? You should know the basic evidences of fiqh. And this is one of the most basic verses the Quran tells you how to do wudu. Surah Ma'idah, verse 6. Okay? O you who believe, when you stand up to pray, then wash your faces and your hands to your elbows. Okay? Wash your faces and your hands to your elbows, and wipe your heads, and wash your feet to your ankles. Okay? So four things are mentioned in the verse. Four things are mentioned in the verse. O you who believe, when you stand up to do wudu, or when you stand up to pray, meaning when you have to do wudu, what did you do? First thing is, wash your face, not the head. Wash the face. Okay? Second thing is, your hands to your elbows. In other words, all of this, all the way, including the elbows. When it means to the elbows, it means including. So you wash till here, this is not wudu. You have to wash till here. Okay? All the way down to the elbows, below the elbows. Okay? And then wipe your head. Wipe your head, meaning you take some water. You don't have to throw water on your head, but you just make your hands wet, and you go like this, wipe your head, and wash your feet to the ankles. Four things are mentioned. Okay, this verse is the verse that is used to differentiate the essential aspects of wudu from the sunnah of wudu. You have to realize that we're going to define this now. Everyone should pay attention specifically to these fiqh terms. What is a rukun, and what is a wajib, and what is a sunan? Understand this. Okay, a rukun is an essential component of the act that you're going to do. So that if you do not perform this component, then that act will not be complete. Okay? Linguistically, rukun means a pillar. The five arkan of Islam, the five pillars of Islam. Okay? So a rukun means something which is essential to that act that you do. If you don't do that act, that rukun, then that act will not be complete. For example, when you pray, right, praying alone without the imam, Surah Fatiha is a rukun. Surah Fatiha, alhamdulillah rabbil alamin, is a rukun. If you don't read Fatiha, it doesn't matter if you read 20 rak'ahs, your prayer is not going to be accepted. Because that rukun, you didn't do it. Likewise, to do ruku', when you go down to ruku', right? If, for example, you forgot the ruku' and you went into sajda immediately, okay? This is a rukun that you've missed. So that rak'ah is not valid. And we're going to get to what you have to do in a while. Let me finish up, we're going too many questions here. We're going to get to what you do in a little while, but the point is, if you missed that rak'ah, then you've missed a rukun. If you missed, you know, bowing down like this, you've missed a rukun. So that rak'ah is invalid. So the point is, a rukun is an act. Does everyone understand what a rukun is? It is an act that is an essential component to the act that you're going to do. And every religious act is composed of many rukuns, usually. Okay, what is a wajib? Obviously, if you leave a rukun, not only are you sinful if you do intentionally, but your act is not accepted. It's not complete. It's incomplete. A wajib. This is different now from the wajib that we defined the first one. We're now talking about from a different, slightly different perspective. We're talking about a wajib versus a rukun versus a sunnah. So put it into context. A wajib is an act that is essential to do. And if you don't do it, you are sinful. Right? But it is possible for you to make up for that act if you don't do it. Whereas a rukun, you can never make up for that act. Do you understand the difference? A wajib is an act that if you miss it, you leave it, then you can somehow make up. There is something you can do to make up for it. Okay? It's not as if you're now gone beyond hope. You have to now do the whole act again. No. There is something that you can do to make up for that act. Okay. A sunnah, on the other hand, everyone knows what a sunnah is. If you do it, you're rewarded. If you don't do it, the act is still complete. So almost every act of Islam is composed of rukuns, of wajibs, and of sunnahs. Do you understand now how we're defining it? Why am I defining it this way? Why do the scholars of fiqh define it this way? They're saying the bare minimum is if you just do the rukun. If you just do the rukun, that's the bare minimum for the act to be complete. And the wajibat, if you miss them out, well, you're sinful, but the act could still be accepted by Allah if you do something to make up for that wajib. Whereas the rukun, you can never make up unless you repeat that rukun or that act again. Sajda Sahw, for example, in prayer, when you make Sajda Sahw, we're going to get to that in a few days, inshallah. Does everyone understand the difference between rukun and wajib? This is very important. Anyone unclear on the concept? For the rukun, either you have to do the whole act over again, or at least do the rukun over again. The point is, you can't make up for it. There's nothing that can substitute for the rukun. The wajib, even though it's obligatory for you to do, and you're sinful for not doing it, there's something that you can do instead, replacing, substituting that act. Okay? So, for example, in the prayer, for example, when you go into ruku', the ruku' is a rukun. But to say Subhana Rabbi al-Azim is a wajib. So if you went into ruku', then you stood up without saying anything, you are sinful. Because it was obligatory for you to say Subhana Rabbi al-Azim. But what is the solution now? Do you have to go back into ruku' and do it again? No. You continue the prayer to the end, and you do something called Sajda Sahu. Or a Sajda of reminder of forgetfulness. We're going to get to all of these rulings later on when we get prayer. The point is, you understand the difference between a rukun and a wajib now? Okay? And a sunnah, obviously, is good if you do it, and if you don't do it, you're not sinful, and the act is still complete in and of itself. Okay? The sunnah is, you're rewarded for doing it. Okay? You're not sinful for leaving it. And the act is complete in and of itself if you do it without the sunnah. So now the wudu is divided into rukuns and sunnahs. The wudu does not have any wajibs to it. The prayer has wajibs relating to it. The wudu does not have any wajibs to it. Yeah. You're rewarded. No. Even if you are able of doing the sunnah and you don't do it, you are not sinful. You have the time to pray your 2 rak'ahs of sunnah and you didn't pray them, you're not sinful. You're not sinful for leaving the sunnah, consciously or unconsciously. Okay, now, the reason I'm doing this, we have to now define everything of wudu. We're going to go over it point by point. First of all, this verse mentions 4 things. What does the verse mention? Quickly. What does the verse mention? The first point. Secondly. Thirdly. Fourthly. Wash your feet to the ankle. So these are for sure 4 rukuns. They're mentioned in the Quran. Okay, add on to them 2 more rukuns. 2 more rukuns of these 4. So you order them 1 through 6. The first rukun, if you like, but really a shout, but I mean, you know, the point is, it's a necessary act of wudu, okay, is the intention. In other words, when you turn the tap on, right, to do wudu, you have to intend, I want to do wudu with this now. Okay, what does it save you out of? For example, if you're walking in the rain, you know, and your whole body became wet, and then you enter the masjid, you say, oh, my whole body became wet, I need to do wudu now. No, because you didn't have the intention. Okay? Or, for example, many people subconsciously, because they're used to doing wudu so much, when they want to chill out, when it's really hot, or they're really sweaty, they just come home and do wudu. So, unconsciously, the very act of wudu, they'll do it, not to do wudu, but just to wipe themselves, to get the sweat away. Okay? Many of us will realize that, for example, we'll start the first few steps of wudu, wash our face and hands, and we don't really want to do wudu. You know, we just want to chill out, or maybe we sweated a lot after playing basketball or something. So the first thing, the first rukun of wudu, or really a shalat, but a rukun if you like, is intention. In other words, you have to have the intention of doing wudu. Okay? The second rukun is washing the face. The third rukun is wiping the hands to the elbows. The fourth one is wiping the face. The fifth one is what is the fifth one? Washing the feet to the ankles. The sixth rukun is doing it in order. Doing the wudu in order. Okay? And the purpose is that the verse mentions it in this order. It doesn't mention it in another order. It mentions it in this order. Okay? So you have to do the wudu in that order. So suppose you started wudu. Okay? First thing you did was you washed your elbows. You washed your hands to your elbows. Yarhamkumullah. You washed it to your elbows. And then you wiped your face. What have you done now? You reversed the order. So then that means you have to ignore what you did before you wash your face and start from washing your face. Because that was the first act. Okay? So you have to do it in the proper order. These are the six rukuns. The six rukuns. Everyone realizes this? Memorize it. And by the way, there will be a final exam in both classes. You do realize that. At least for me, I don't know about the other teachers. For me, there's going to be a final exam. Brothers and sisters, there will be a finally comprehensive exam. So, take good notes. Now, we're going to get to the details. Right now, we're just talking about rukuns right now, okay? These are the six rukuns of wudu, okay? The niyyah, which is the intention, and then the four aspects which are mentioned in the verse, and then making sure that it is done in sequential order. Now there's a seventh thing which many people say is a rukun, and many people say it's not, and me personally, I don't know the correct answer. I mean, I haven't decided is it a rukun or not, so I'll just tell it to you, and either way, it's very, very important, okay, because there's a difference between a rukun or not. Some people say it's a rukun, and some people say it's wajib. Okay, this seventh thing is to do everything in a short period of time. In other words, what are we taking out of this? For example, someone wakes up at 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay, he washes his hands and his face. Then he goes to work, and then at work he realizes, well, I have to pray. Well, I already washed my hands and face. Let me just continue from where I left off after 3 hours. Okay, is that allowed or not? According to majority, no, it's not, and some scholars say it is. And really, there is a valid difference of opinion over this. So I myself. I'm hesitant, but for safety's sake, just put it down as a rukun and put in brackets difference between it. Okay, that the seventh thing of rukun is to do it in a short period of time. Now, what is qualified as a short period of time? The scholars say that what is qualified as short is that the limb that you just washed doesn't dry until you wash the next one. Okay, so suppose you're washing your face and then the water goes off. Okay, you quickly run to another restroom or another place to get water. Okay, if the water on your face hasn't dried in the meantime, then in that case you can continue from there. Okay? If it has, then you have to start all over again. So you see how this becomes practical. I mean, this rukun. Okay? So put it down as a rukun, and then you can bracket difference of opinion, you know, over it. But just to be on the safe side, you don't lose anything by continuing by counting as a rukun. Okay? Now, the sunnahs of wudu are many. The sunnahs of wudu are many. Of them is to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When you start wudu, okay, you should say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and this is based on the hadith of Prophet. No one has, if you like, perfected his wudu. La wudu aliman lam yadhkur ismullah alayh. No one has, if you like, perfected his wudu until he mentions the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is the first thing, is the sunnah. Second thing is to wash yourself more than once. In other words, at least 3 times. The sunnah is to wash it 3 times, but all are allowed. 1, 2, 3. Once is allowed to wash yourself, once is allowed to wash yourself, twice is allowed. But the sunnah, or the best, to wash yourself 3 times and not more than 3 times. Okay? Now obviously, what does that mean is that when you wash any part of the body, you do it 3 times. Like once, then you do it twice, and then 3 times. Okay? If you do it once, it's allowed. If you do it twice, it's allowed. But the sunnah, or the best, is to do it 3 times. All of the sunnah is that when you start the wudu, the first thing that you do is you wash your hands to the wrists. Okay? The hands to the wrists. This is not a kun, but this is a sunnah. Okay? You wash the hands to the wrists. Okay? And then once you've done that, you wash your hands to the wrists, then you do something called maldmada and istinshaf. What is maldma? To throw water into your mouth, or basically take water into your mouth and gargle it, or to move it around in your mouth. Not gargle really, but just to move it around your mouth and spit it out. Okay. No, you don't have to gargle. You just throw it into your mouth and you shake it around your mouth. That's the point. You have to move it with tongue and your cheeks. You have to move it all around your mouth. Many people, they just take water into their mouth and spit it out again. That's wrong. You have to take the water in and literally take it in, out, all over. And this is really the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He has given us these type of detailed hygienic rules that we cleanse our mouths and we cleanse our souls and we cleanse our bodies so clearly and so detailedly. Now you throw water into your mouth and you move it around. What's a good word for gurgling? I don't know. Huh? Splash it around, okay? Squish it around, okay? And then you throw it out, okay? And with the same movement, once you've done that, with the same movement, you suck water up into your nose. You suck water up to your nose. This is called istinshaq, okay? And then you blow it out to cleanse your mouth, or to cleanse your nose, excuse me. You blow it out. The sunnah is to do with the same movement, and it takes some practice, but it's very easy to do. You just, after you take some water here, a little bit of it, you take into your mouth, the rest of it, you throw. And while you throw it up, you're moving your mouth. So, you have to practice it a bit, okay? Perhaps before the prayer, I can demonstrate for the brothers, inshallah, that I'm a full wudu. You know, I think that would be a good idea. Perhaps demonstrate the full wudu. The sunnah is you do it in one sweeping motion like that, both together. Now, there's a difference of opinion concerning the madmada and istinshaq. Is this a rukun or not? Now, those that say it's a rukun, what do you think it'll come under in the rukun? Look at the rukuns that we wrote. Washing face, exactly. Some of the scholars, the Hanbalis in particular, they said that gurgling and cleansing the nose, it falls under the verse in the Quran which says, wash your face. Why? Because your mouth and your nose are a part of your face. Okay? And it seems, and Allah knows best, that this is the correct opinion. So this also then is a rukun of wudu, according to this opinion. It's a rukun. That because this is included in washing the face, you have to wash, you have to gurgle the water in your mouth and also cleanse your nose. Okay, this is a part of a rukun of wudu. And if you don't do it, according to this opinion, it's not complete wudu. Okay? After you've done that, then you wash face. What is the definition of the face? The face is from ear to ear and from forehead to chin. Okay? Ear to ear, which is right where this thing starts, okay? And forehead to chin. Forehead is like where the place where your hair starts. If someone is growing bald, he doesn't go back to where his hair starts, but he goes to where it generally starts. Okay? Nothing personal. He goes back to where his hair starts, okay? So you look at the general criteria. Suppose, for example, I mean, you know, we see Kalazar, if someone doesn't have an ear or something, it doesn't go back to nothing. I mean, he goes back to where generally the ear should start. Okay? So from ear to ear and from forehead to chin. This is the face. So he has to make sure that every millimeter of his face is washed. Water touches it and is washed. Except for the inside of the eyes. You don't have to throw water inside the eyes. Understood. You don't have to throw water inside the eyes. But apart from that, everything inside the face has to be washed with water. The brothers with beards, okay, it is not required your beard is thick like this one. Okay, if your beard is thin, like some of the brothers, their beards are thin, it is obligated then for the water to reach the skin. Okay, if your beard is thin, it's obligatory, or you don't have a beard, it's obligatory that your water touches the cheeks. Okay, but if you have a thick beard like this, it's not obligatory for it to reach the skin, because that would be ridiculous. It means you have to throw water in all over, you know, and make sure it's real wet, so you come out for at least 10-20 minutes, water's going to be dripping. You're not required to do that. What you are required to do is just wash the outer side of the beard. In other words, when you wash the face, just take the water over your beard, like that. Okay. Also, it is sunnah to wipe the underside of the beard too. Like the Prophet ﷺ, he would take water like this, and he would throw it underneath his beard. I can't demonstrate with this on, but like this, he would throw it underneath to wipe this part of the beard. Okay. And also, it's also sunnah to take your thing through your beard. So the Prophet ﷺ would take water, and then he'd go like this through his beard, like that. So it's also sunnah to do that. Okay. After a person does this, then he takes water to wash his elbows, all the way to his elbows. Like we said, elbows inclusive, important. If you don't wash all the way to the end of the elbow, that means that you haven't completed your wudu. Elbows inclusive, all the way down. Okay. So if you're a bit more and you go a bit more, it's better for you just to be on the safe side. Okay. Yani, instead of like stopping over here, right? Go a little bit more, just to be on the safe side that your full elbow has been included in the wudu area. Okay, you wash both of them. Like we said, it's best to do it three times, and if you do it once, it's all right. A question arises, do I have to rub when I do wudu? Okay, brothers, do I have to rub, make sure everything approaches? Or if I just put my hand under the sink like this and make sure everything is wet? Now, the correct opinion is that as long as everything is wet, you don't have to rub. Okay, but if you think that there's a point training, then you have to rub. And this will especially come into play when you have a little amount of water. You know, the Prophet would do wudu with a very small amount of water, maybe like half of this cup. He would do a complete wudu. Okay? And I've done it a number of times. I mean, sometimes you have to do it living in Medina, and you know you don't have Some places where you have to do wudu very a small amount of water, and it's very easy once you get hang of it. We're used to spending a lot of water and wasting a lot of water, and this is against the sunnah. This is israf, this is wastage. We should try to use as little water as possible. But the point is, when you have a very little amount of water, then you have to just put a little bit of water in your hand and quickly rub all over your hand to make sure everything is wet. As long as your entire hand is wet, you have done wudu, even if you only used a few ounces of water. Okay. Now, if you put your hand under the sink all the way when it becomes wet, then you don't have to rub it either. And that's also allowed. Okay? Okay. So the point is, it's not obligatory to rub every part of the body. Supposing you're standing under a shower, and you just put your head up, and your face is going to become wet. Suppose you're doing wudu in the shower for some reason. You know? You don't have to rub everything left and right. Okay? After you complete washing the hand, then you have to wipe the face. Now, how much of, not the face, the head. How much of the head do you have to wipe? The correct opinion is that you have to wipe the entire head. You have to wipe the entire head. You can't just go like some scholars say, you take one hair and you go like that and you've wiped your head. You know? No, really, I'm not joking. This is what some scholars say. This is not true. This is not correct. The Quran says, wipe your head, which means you have to wipe the entire head. So you take water like this, and the Prophet ﷺ sunnah. Now, to wipe the head is fard, is rukun. But how you do it, is the sunnah way to it, is that you take water like this, and you go back all the way, and then you come back all the way. Okay? So you go back all the way, and then come back all the way. Or you can start from the back. You come back, and then you come forth again. Right above the neck. You don't have to wash the neck. So, yes. A common misconception is that you have to wash the neck. No, you do not have to wash the neck. Washing the neck is not a part of wudu. Washing the neck is not a part of wudu. Okay? You just have to go to the hair of your head. There. And then go back up. The sunnah is you go like this. Or you go backwards and forwards. Or even if you just do it once, you've done your job. That you've done your rukun. You've done your rukun. But the sunnah is that you do it twice. Okay? Backwards and then forwards. So you have to wash or you wipe your entire head with wet hands. You don't have to take water and throw it on your head. But you just go like this and go like this. Now, there's one exception to wiping the entire head, and that when a brother is wearing a turban. When a brother is wearing a turban, a real turban, not the type that the Saudis wear, but the type that the Sudanese, for example, all the way around, right? In this case, it is allowed for him just to wipe the portion. Just move the turban a bit up, touch it with his hand, and that's it. Move it back, okay? Likewise, the sisters, when they are wearing their scarves, and it is difficult for them to take it off, in this case, they can wash the front portion of their heads only, and they don't have to take the entire scarf off. But it is encouraged if, for example, they're in a ladies' restroom, there's no problem, then they should take off their entire scarf. But if they need to, if need be, then they are allowed to, if their scarf is difficult to take off, they're allowed to just wash the front part of their heads, and then they don't have to wash the entire back of their head. Okay. After that, obviously you should wash the ears. And some of the scholars have said that the ears are also a rukun to wash. What do they base that on? Which portion of the rukuns do you think they're going to come to there? No. The face by ijma' is from ear to ear. The head. They say the ears, they follow the head. You see, so some scholars included the nose and the mouth following the face. Some scholars include the ears following the head. Okay? And meaning that since the head is obligatory to wash, so too are the ears. And this is perhaps the correct opinion because the Prophet ﷺ said in an authentic hadith, he said, "Al-udhunani min al-ra'as," that the ears are part of the head. So he is defining now, the Prophet ﷺ is defining now, for the sake of the Islamic yani, you know, wudu or something, the ears, they follow under the head. So since it is obligatory to wash to wipe the head, it is obligatory to wipe the ears too. So you take some water, you make sure your hands are wet, and you just go over the grooves of your ear, and with your thumb you go behind the ears. Okay? So after you've washed the head, then you go over inside the grooves of your ears with this hand, and with your thumb you wipe behind the ear. And according to the correct opinion, this is al-kun. Means you have to do this in order to make your wudu complete. Okay, let's finish up because we're getting a bit late. Questions at the end. At the end of that is, at the end of that, or when you finish the wudu, then you wash your feet, right? You wash your feet till your ankles. Once again, your ankles have to be included in the washing. So just to be on the safe side, you should go a bit above just the ankles. Just to be on the safe side, you should go just above the ankles and wash them. It is sunnah, it is not rukun, to go in between your toes, okay? Using a finger, either this finger or that, any finger, just to wipe between your toes. But it is not a rukun, it is sunnah to do so, okay? Likewise, it is sunnah to begin with everything from the right-hand side versus the left-hand side. It's not rukun, it's sunnah. So when you start washing your hands, you start with the right, and then you go from the left. Likewise, with your feet, you start from the right, and then you start from the left. It is sunnah to do that. It is not a rukun. What else? What have we left out? Obviously, when you finish the dua. The dua, what is the dua when you finish your wudu? Who knows? The Prophet said, whoever does this type of wudu that he did, and then says, أَشْهَدُ أَنْ لَا إِلَٰهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ وَحْدَهُ لَا شَرِكَ وَأَشْهَدُ أَنَّ مُحَمَّدًا عَبْدُهُ وَرَسُولُهُ. All of the 8 gates of paradise, the 8 doors of paradise will be opened for him. Okay? It's a very small thing to do for a very large reward. You know, every time you do wudu, memorize this dua. It's very easy. أَشْهَدُ أَلَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ وَحْدَهُ لَا شَرِكَ لَهُ وَأَشْهَدُ أَنَّ مُحَمَّدًا عَبْدُهُ وَرَسُولُهُ. Okay? It's very easy. اللهم اجعلني من التوابين واجعلني من المتطهرين. Right? That's the end of the dua. اللهم اجعلني من التوابين واجعلني من المتطهرين. It's a very easy dua. Once you finished it, when you finish your wudu, then you should say this dua. And it's a very small thing to say, which you get the rewards are very great. Let me check, is there anything left? Yes, another sunnah of wudu. Another sunnah of wudu that I forgot. You should try to exaggerate concerning washing your mouth and nose. In other words, this is something which we're not used to, accustomed to. It takes a while to get used to. Try your best to wash your nose. And when you throw water in, blow it in a lot. And this will hurt you in the beginning. This will pin you. It will really burn. But after a while, you get used to it. And not only that, but you will feel for yourself how clean your nose becomes. And I'm speaking from experience that when I didn't used to do this, I started doing it this way, right? Wallah, you feel for yourself how clean your nose is. When you get used to it, in the beginning it's going to burn. You literally suck up the water like that. You suck it up, you know, and then you blow it out. Now you don't drown yourself, you don't continue to, just a little bit of water, you suck it up, and then you blow it out, okay? For a few weeks it's going to burn, it's going to feel painful. After a while you will realize for yourself how clean your nose feels, how clean it is, you know, and even your breathing, it becomes much easier for you. And this, again, I hear that scientifically this is important, but once again, we don't care whether it's proven or not. We follow the sunnah, and it is good enough for us to follow the sunnah, you know. But someone told me that a researcher in England or something, he found that some type of cancer of the nose, it is very rare amongst Muslims and is very common amongst non-Muslims. And when he did research, he found that because the Muslims regularly cleanse themselves in wudu, it was because of Allahu A'lam. I mean, this type of stuff, we don't base our religion on it, you know. Also, like we mentioned, it is encouraged to do wudu 3 times for every limb except for one, and that is the head. The head is sunnah to do it once. We don't do it 3 times. But every other limb, if you do it once, it's all right. That's the rukun. If you do it twice, it's better. If you do it 3 times, it's best. Okay? And also, to increase more than this, this is against the sunnah. You might even get some sin for doing this, increasing against this. Okay? You should just do it maximum of 3 times, and that's it. Also, you should do siwak after the wudu. We mentioned this, okay? I think we have finished wudu. And let's just finish one more topic before we call it a day. You realize I am going fast, but we only have 15 more days, 16 more days, you know? 2.5, 3 weeks. I want us to finish a lot of stuff, you know? I want us to finish a lot of stuff before we move on. One more topic, inshallah, and then we'll open the floor for questions. Okay, a very important topic, and we're going to make it short. Wiping over the socks. Masah ala al-khuffain. Wiping over the socks. All of the scholars of Islam, of Ahlul Sunnah al-Jama'ah, they have allowed wiping over the khufs. They have allowed the wiping over the socks. Okay? This is because more than 70 companions reported this act from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So it is mutawatir. In other words, it has been narrated, excuse me, well, I'm tired. It has been narrated by more than 70 companions. Okay? So it is mutawatir. In other words, there is no difference of opinion or doubt concerning the fact that you can wipe over the socks. Okay? The question arises, so what are the characteristics of this socks and how long can you, all of this is where the ikhtilaf comes. Okay. Now, how long can you do it? It's well known. 1 day, 24 hours for the one who is not traveling, and 3 days, 72 hours for the ones who is traveling. Okay. So once you put on the sock, right, and you perform the masah, or you perform the wiping over the socks, you are allowed for one day and night, meaning 24 hours from whenever you started, to wipe over if you're not traveling. So if you're in Houston, for 1 day, when you put your socks on, the time that you put your socks on from, 24 hours till the next time, you know, till the next 24 hours, you can wipe over that sock. The condition, though, is that you had wudu before you put the sock on. Okay? This is the condition. The hadith, the proof of this is the hadith of Jubayr ibn Mut'im, that he was accompanying the Prophet on a journey, and the Prophet, he was giving the Prophet the water to make wudu from. So when time came to wash his feet, Jubayr ibn Mut'im, he tried to take his socks off. And this shows you the eagerness that the Sahaba had in serving the Prophet. But the Prophet said, leave them on, for I put them on while I was on a state of wudu. Okay? So the Prophet put on socks while he was in a state of wudu. Because of that, he was allowed to wipe over them for the next day or for the next 3 days if you're traveling. Okay? So the condition is, when you perform wudu, you put your socks on. And it doesn't mean you have to put them on immediately, but it means that you have to have wudu when you put your socks on. So suppose you did wudu at 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay? At 11:30 or 12 o'clock, right before dhuhr, 1 hour before dhuhr, you put your socks on. Then you broke your wudu before dhuhr. Okay? Now, you know, when you do wudu again, you don't have to take your socks off. Why? Because when you put them on, you have wudu. Okay? So the key or the criterion is that when you put your socks on, you have wudu. And then from 11 o'clock until next 11 o'clock, you have the opportunity to wipe over the socks, according to this example that we gave, 24 hours, okay? From the time you put your socks on. Or 30, or 3 days, depending on if you're traveling. If you're traveling, it's 3 full days. Okay? Now, a lot of scholars have gone to a lot of different opinions concerning the characteristics of this sock. Okay, so Hanafis, they are the most strict, and everyone knows that you have to have a thick sock, according to Hanafis, okay? You can't have a thin sock, okay? But inshallah, the correct opinion is that any sock will do, even if it has some holes in it, as long as you call it a sock. As long as it's something that you wear to, you know, put yourself between. And likewise, shoes all obviously have the same ruling, same hukum. But anything that you call a sock, except certain socks which are so thin, so transparent that you can see the skin underneath them. Okay. Particularly, what do you call those things that the ladies wear? The liners, right? The hose, right? Yeah. Those type of socks, Allahu A'lam, they wouldn't qualify because they're too thin. Okay. You can see the skin and you can see beyond it. These, they don't qualify as socks. But everything that qualifies us, that you would call a sock, they don't even call it a sock, they call it a pantyhose, right? They don't even call it a sock, okay? Is that those type of things that you would qualify as anything, that, you know, all the brothers that are wearing these socks here, they would qualify. Okay, even if it's thin, but it's not so thin or so tight you can see the skin color or it's transparent, that wouldn't qualify to do masah over. Also, it has to cover the ankles. Okay, the sock has to cover the ankle. So if it's going below the ankles, that doesn't qualify as a sock. Okay, and if it has a few holes in it, that's fine. Because the Prophet ﷺ didn't mention anything, and it's well known, socks always have holes in them. Okay, used socks that always have holes. Despite that fact, the Prophet ﷺ did not mention to the Sahaba that if your socks have holes in them, you cannot do masah. No, he told them you can do masah. So as long as you call it a sock, as long as you wear it as a sock, you can perform masah over it for 24 hours or for 72 of your travel. Okay. Once the 24 hours are over, you're not allowed to continue doing masah over those socks. Okay. In other words, if you did masah at 11 o'clock for the first time, as soon as 11 o'clock of the next day comes, you have to perform wudu all over again. You have to perform wudu all over again. The question arises, suppose you did masah over the socks at dhuhr time, okay? I mean, you broke your wudu at 11, going back to our example. You did masah at 12 o'clock before dhuhr, and then you prayed dhuhr. Before asr, you came back home and you took your shoes and socks off. Okay? You took your shoes and socks off. Now you've done two wudus. The first wudu was before you put masah on. So that was a full wudu. Then you put the socks on, and then you broke your wudu again. And then you did an incomplete wudu. Why? Because you didn't wash your feet. You only wiped over them. Okay? Now you took your socks off. So, do you go back to the first wudu, in which case you broke it between the second wudu, or you go back to the second wudu, in which case you have it? In other words, the question is, okay, to put it very, very simply, I'm getting complicated here, the question is, once you take your socks off, and you had wudu, do you still have wudu or not? You see my question, you see my point. Suppose you did masah over the socks, okay, and you prayed some prayers. Now you went home and you didn't break your wudu after that masah. You didn't break your wudu after you wiped over the socks, right? But you took your shoes off, you took your socks off. Does that break your wudu or not? You want to have a vote that we go right? There's a big difference of opinion. The majority say it does break your wudu, believe it or not. But the correct opinion is that it doesn't break your wudu. Inshallah, the correct opinion is that it does not break your wudu. Until you break it again after that, obviously. Okay? Obviously, if you broke it after that. It's safer to do it over again, for sure. But the correct opinion is that it does not break your wudu. So once you take your socks off after you've had them, and you did mess up over the socks, if you take those socks off, it does not break your wudu just by taking those socks off. Okay? And like we mentioned, the women, they can do masah over their scarves. But the point is, when you touch the front of your scarf, then the rest of your scarf, or the brothers, if any wear turbans, you should go over the rest of your scarf with your hands. That's what you call masah. So you're allowed to do masah over two things. Your shoes and a headgear, a head turban or a scarf. Okay, the masah for the shoes, the condition is that you have to have wudu before you put them on. This condition is not applicable for the scarf or the turban. If you have a turban or a scarf on, it doesn't matter whether you had wudu when you put it on or not. Okay, it doesn't matter. You can just do it like that. Okay. Likewise, there's no time limit for the scarf or the turban. Unlike the shoe, there is a time limit. It has to last for 24 hours or 72 hours if you're traveling. I think we've covered everything when it comes to that. Let me just quickly go over before we answer any questions. Obviously, a shoe can also be over. It's understood. If you can do it over a sock, you can do it over a shoe. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that's pretty much it. We've covered everything. So today we covered how many topics? What's the first topic we covered? Chapter of utensils. Utensils. We defined tahara, but the chapter was a chapter of utensils. After that, what do we cover? Well, what do we say about utensils? A quick summary. Everything is allowed unless it's gold and silver, or it's made from an impure hide or tan. Okay? What else do we cover after that? Etiquette of the restroom. And then after that we covered personal hygiene. Okay. After that was miswak. Quickly, just a brief thing on miswak. We just said it's sunnah at all times and it pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The Prophet said, do using the miswak pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then we covered wudu, and then we covered wiping. So we covered six chapters today. Okay. These are very important chapters. You have to realize we're going at a very fast rate. We're skipping a lot of topics, okay? We're just going over the bare essentials of what you need to know, okay? These topics, they could take a real student of knowledge literally months and years to go over every single one of these topics. To go over every single method, to go over the evidences. And, you know, we spent like a whole year or half a year on these type of topics. I went over them in 1 hour, okay? Reason is, we want to cover a lot of topics, and I just want you to know the basics. Just worship Allah in this manner, and then study more, and have your own opinions, research, ask the scholars. You know now what to ask. You say, well, what is the correct opinion concerning taking off the socks? Does that break wudu? I told you it doesn't. Other scholars say, yes, it does. Well, what's your evidence? When you get to that level, become more active, become more curious. What's your evidence? How come you said it didn't? What do you say it does, you know? Think about it, ponder. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this is the religion of Allah, you know? So right now, temporarily, just, you know, follow what you can, but eventually, inshallah, you have to move beyond this level and start asking questions, reading more books, inshallah. So inshallah, with that, I ask that the brothers, maybe every 2-3 questions for the sisters and one for the brothers, because the sisters have a lot and I can't obviously talk to them. I can talk to you after the class, so that's why.
Okay, the first of these is, silk and gold are forbidden for men to wear, but they are pure objects. With the same analogy, alcohol is forbidden but is also pure. But it is allowed in the cases of perfume, lotion, or cologne. Can you explain why?
The fact that alcohol is pure is not a fact. It's a difference of opinion. The majority of ulama, the majority of scholars, they stated that alcohol is impure. It's najis. Okay? So based on that, alcoholic perfumes, cologne, aftershaves, all of this would be impure. So if someone uses something like this, then he must wash it away from himself before he prays. Okay? Some slight, smaller, not slight, I mean, you know, minor, the minor difference, I mean, in the sense that the lesser group, or the smaller quantity of scholars, they said that alcohol is not najis, okay, it's not najis. But the majority say that it is najis, and based on that opinion, colognes and aftershaves and stuff, if you ever use them, lotions that have alcohol, you have to wipe it away or make sure it's not left on you before you would pray. Okay. Allahu A'lam. No, but the point is you have to make a differentiation. If you use alcohol, right? If you use alcohol, you might be allowed to use alcohol, but if najis, you're not allowed to pray in it. So if you use some alcohol to kill the germs and then put the shot in, right? As soon as you take the shot, then wipe away the alcohol. You have to differentiate between, like if you touch a najis, okay, another point, we're going to get to the things that break wudu, but if you touch a najis object, it doesn't break your wudu, right? If you touch a najis, if urine falls back on you, your wudu would have been broken not by the urine, but by your urinating, okay? So if someone else's urine falls on you, it doesn't break your wudu. Okay, it's just najis. So that means that you have to wipe it before going to prayer. Obviously, as fast as possible. The point is, the latest time you can wash it is before going to prayer. No.
This is going to the question concerning etiquettes of the restroom. Is there a difference in Allah's name if it is written in Arabic or in English? If I have a t-shirt that has an ayah of the Quran on it, can I wear this in the restroom?
Definitely the speech of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Qur'an, is only Arabic. So anything in English is not the Qur'an. Okay? However, the point is, it's still a translation of the Qur'an. So you still should show respect to it. Not the respect is shown to the Mus'haf or the Arabic, but still there should be some respect to it. Even if it's in English, okay? It doesn't hold the same level of respect, the same level that the Arabic does, but still it is a transliteration or a translation of the meanings. And as such, a person should be cautious and beware of wearing such things into. And I would strongly advise the brothers and the sisters not to wear t-shirts or articles of clothing that have Allah's name or His Messenger's name on them. This is not at all. It might lead to minor shirk, which we're going to get to in a little while. Okay? But at the same time, najis might fall on it. You're going to expose it to najis. What if you do an evil deed wearing this thing? It doesn't look very good. You're wearing a shirt, you know, I love Allah, and you're doing something maybe that's not allowed to do, you know. I mean, it doesn't, it's not befitting. Okay? Yani, some people think this is a good way of da'wah. I personally disagree, you know, I mean, with all due respect, I disagree. I don't think it's good to have car bumper stickers or something. This is not the proper place to advertise about Islam on your bumper sticker, you know. It's not the proper way to give da'wah. This is my opinion. I'm not saying it's haram or halal. I'm saying personally, I don't like it. I don't have these type of things. I don't like it. There are ways of giving da'wah by your akhlaq, by your manners, by your conduct, you know, not a little bumper sticker. I mean, perhaps somebody might come out of it, but I personally would not advise the brothers or sisters to wear shirts or memorabilia or anything like this. You can look Islamic, akhi. This is a better da'wah than wearing a t-shirt that says, I'm a Muslim. You can look Islamic. The sisters, they wear their hijab. This speaks louder than 1,000 words on your t-shirt, that I'm a Muslim. Likewise, the brother, he has a beard and he looks like a Muslim. This is louder than 1,000 t-shirts you can wear. You know, by your khlaq, by your manners, give da'wah. This is my advice.
Does a regular shower take place of the wudu?
Yes, if you performed the ghusl, a shower, with the intention of ghusl, right? In the sense you want to do ghusl. We're going to get to ghusl maybe tomorrow, inshallah. But if you do ghusl, since ghusl is higher than wudu is obviously lower than ghusl. I mean, ghusl is a more thorough way of cleaning yourself than ghusl, than wudu. When you do wudu, this automatically, you are doing, when you do ghusl, excuse me, you automatically are doing wudu at the same time. Okay? Because it's higher than wudu. Yeah.
Is it allowed to pray Salah with shoes on, shoes that go into public restrooms, etc.?
Okay, very good question, which I actually forgot to mention when we were talking about najasa. We mentioned that there's an exception, for example, for human urine, if it's from an unweaned male infant, right? There is another exception also, and that is for footwear, okay, for najasa. If your footwear comes in touch with najasa, okay, the Prophet ﷺ said, all you have to do is walk. You continue walking and the najasa will be considered as if it's gone. Whereas this doesn't apply to clothes. If you drag it in the sand, it's not going to become pure. But the Prophet ﷺ made an exception for the shoes. Okay? He made an exception for shoes. He said, if you encounter anything with najas on your shoes, just continue walking or, you know, go a few paces, and that will count as having purified the najasa. So, based on that hadith, which is an authentic hadith, it is allowed to pray in shoes. However, it is not wise, nor is it admissible, nor is it very good to walk into our present-day masjid with your shoes on. Because you're going to cause harm. The carpets have been made very nice, very clean. You don't want to make it dirty. You have to realize this hadith was applied when the Prophet's masjid was sand. Okay, so if we're in the similar situation, if we're praying on a field, right, or if we're praying, for example, the Eid prayers are offered in the field, it's wise to pray in your shoes. You know, it's sunnah to pray in your shoes, actually, in these types of situations. To take your shoes off is not obligatory. But in our modern masjids, it's really stupid and you're causing a big fitna if you think you're applying the hadith in this manner. No, the hadith is not meant to be applied in all places and all times. No, you're not being very wise in applying the hadith in this manner. You should take your shoes off because you're causing harm to the people, you're causing the shoes to dirty the masjid, you're causing smells to come in. We don't need it. We have, alhamdulillah, carpets now. You know, so it's wise to take your shoes off.
Is it the sunnah not to dry yourself after wudu?
Both are allowed. You can dry yourself and you cannot dry yourself. In the sense the Prophet ﷺ sometimes used to, sometimes he wouldn't, you know. Also, it's wise, if you're going to pray in your shoes, it's wise to just check, is there any najis on them or not. If there is, then just rub them in the dirt and then pray in them, okay? Otherwise, this is because the Prophet ﷺ was once praying, and in the middle of the prayer, he took his shoes off. So the shoes, he was praying with his shoes on in the masjid. Okay, like I said, take it into context, those times masjids, okay? He took his shoes off. When the Sahaba saw that, all of them, they took their shoes off. Which shows you that they too were all praying in their shoes. And it shows you the love that they had. That they didn't even know why the Prophet took it out. Immediately, all took their shoes off and put them aside. Okay? After the prayer, the Prophet said, why did you take your shoes off? They said, we saw you take your shoes off, therefore we took them off. The Prophet ﷺ responded, Jibreel came to me and told me that my shoes had a najis on them. Had some dirty impurity on them. Therefore, I took them off. Therefore, when you pray, just check sure that, you know, there's no najis on it. So if there is, all you have to do is rub your feet in the sand or, you know, walk a few feet, and it will be considered as if that najis is then forgiven for you. Even if there is something left on it, if you wipe your feet in the sand or you walk a few paces, that najis has been forgiven from you. Yeah.
I have heard that you are not allowed to even talk in the bathroom. For example, while talking in the shower or while on the toilet. And also, does changing your clothes break the wudu?
Changing your clothes does not break the wudu unless you do something while changing the clothes. Doesn't break your wudu just by changing the clothes. Talking in the bathroom, there is a weak hadith reported that the Prophet ﷺ said that do not speak while using the restroom, for verily whoever does so, Allah's great anger will descend upon him. Okay? So the principle is correct, but the hadith is not authentic. And one hadith is given the curse of Allah on these people. This is not authentic, this hadith. But the point is, yes, it is not a part of a Muslim adab, Muslim culture. You know, it's not a part of a person who has a sense of modesty to speak while he is urinating or defecating, you know. It is goes against the person's shyness, okay. This is a very disgusting thing that every one of us has to. He shouldn't make it a point of conversation or time to talk or anything like this, you know, or to read or to talk. No, he should go there, do his stuff and come out. So yes, it is correct, you should not talk, not necessarily in the bathroom, in the sense, while you're doing wudu, you can talk, right? But using the restroom, when you're in the actual restroom and you're using the restroom, you should not talk at the time. No.
Okay, we have another question here. Concerning alcohol, are we allowed to eat in a restaurant which has any type of beer or wine?
What is prohibited, it is better to avoid these type of places, but what is prohibited is to sit at a table where alcohol is served. So if you're sitting at a table with a bunch of non-Muslim friends and they have alcohol, the Prophet ﷺ said that whoever believes in Allah and the last day will not sit at a table where alcohol is served, or should not sit at a table where alcohol is served. So this is a very severe warning. But the warning is against the table. Okay, so you should not sit at those type of tables. So, and definitely we should avoid those restaurants that have alcohol, and especially pubs and stuff that even if you go to, I mean, why would you, you know, I mean, if you go to a pub with your, suppose some Muslims, they go to their pubs with their non-Muslim friends, and they're not going to drink alcohol. It's ridiculous. Why would you go to type of places? But if you do go to a restaurant where alcohol is served, inshallah, it's, you know, it's allowed, but don't make sure the alcohol is not on your table, you know.
Is it allowed to use the restroom in front of a spouse, even if you only have one bathroom and are in a rush? Is there a difference between physically being present and if you're not looking at the spouse?
Yeah, it is allowed because the spouses are allowed to look at the awra or the private parts of each other. They're allowed to. But obviously, I mean, it's more perfect in your shyness to be secluded. But it is allowed. And you're not sinful to do that.
For wiping the head back and forth, how about sisters which have long hair?
The sisters that have long hair, they don't have to wipe the hair, they have to wipe the head, which means you still go stop right here. You don't go all the way back, you know, you just stop at the hair, okay? You just stop at the head, you have to wipe the head, you don't have to wipe the hair. When you just go like this, then that's it, you move on.
Okay, this is also going back to etiquette of the restroom, and one of the points made was you should not stay in the restroom for a long time. But it says, I've been told that staying in the restroom after urinating for a while is good because you're still discharging drops of urine.
Concerning staying in the restroom for a long time, there's no doubt you should avoid it as much as possible. However, you have to ensure that all your urine has exited, right? So if the only way to ensure it is to stay a little bit longer, then this is allowed because you're still making sure that urine exits. But at the same time, realize that shaitan, one of the most, if you like, easiest ways that he misguides people and he causes them to ponder and think is through restroom and through hygiene. He'll come to you and say, oh, you didn't cleanse yourself. Oh, there's still some drops left. Oh, this, oh, that. So he'll just waste your time. And he just loves causing problems. He just loves causing problems. That's his job, right? So if he can't get you to do an evil deed, he'll get you involved in what you think is a good deed. So we have to avoid going to extremes in the restrooms, you know. Is that, I didn't get too explicit, but there are some things that, you know, the scholars, the books of fiqh mention, going, you know, to extremes. Is that, you know, jumping up and down, making sure that everything has exited your body, and you know, doing extreme things. That you should just be cautious, but don't go into extremes. Okay, like I said, the men, they should shake themselves a little bit, make sure that the urine has exited. That's it. Don't have to now, you know, bother yourself. After that, wash yourself with water or with pure substances and move on then. Okay, don't let Sean come and give you his whisperings like, oh, do this, do that. You haven't cleansed yourself. There's still something left. No, do what you have to and make sure that it's good, and that's. And that's why the scholars say that after you urinate, it is advisable for brothers and sisters both just to take a little bit of water and wet your undergarments. Wet your underwear, if you like, or undergarments. Why? So that if you feel something wet, shaitan can't make you think it's your urine. You'll know it's your urine. Because that's what happens. If you wipe yourself with dry things, Shaitan comes to you and says, oh, I thought I felt a drop. I thought I felt it. I broke my wudu. I got it. This is all Shaitan's whispering to you. To remove this, just take a little bit of water and throw it on your undergarment. So that you know that if you feel something, you say, no, it's the water that I put. It's not my urine. Okay? Remember, don't let Shaitan take you into extremes. So, I mean, to answer the sister's questions, do what you have to. I mean, if you have to a little bit longer to make sure that the urine comes out, that's fine and that's good. But don't let Shaitan take you into extremes.
Yes, this is the last question before we break for lunch. And it is, what is the difference between wajib and fard? Is it that when you leave fard like salah, it takes out of the fold of Islam, and wajib like growing the beard will not take out of the fold of Islam?
This goes back to something called usul al-fiqh, or the sciences of fiqh, okay? You know that there are four madhabs in existence, there are more than four. One of the madhabs, they made a differentiation between fard and wajib. And this is the definition that the sister gave, is that they said fard is something which if you don't do it, if you deny it, you're a kafir, basically. Not don't do it. If you deny it, you're a kafir. Whereas wajib is something, if you deny it, you're not a kafir. And they have the differences too. But the majority of the scholars, they did not make a differentiation between fard and wajib, and they said that they're synonyms. They mean the same thing. Fard means wajib, wajib means fard. Okay? And the methodology or the content I'm using means that they're the same thing. If I say fard, if I say wajib, it's the same thing. Okay? Some scholars are differentiated, but their differentiation is not based upon very strong principles. Do you want to quickly mention that? That's a quick one. I can do that. Yeah. What? Oh, it's not? Okay. Okay, Tayyib, inshallah. So if the brothers have any questions, and perhaps right before the prayer, I can demonstrate the complete wudu for the brothers, inshallah. No, this is a real question, I think. The sister is asking, how come you only mentioned arkan and sunnah and not wajibat? I told you, sunnah don't have any wajibat right now. Okay, the fard prayers, they are the things that have rukun, sunnah, and wajib. The wudu, it only has rukun and sunnah. Some aspects, they only have rukun. Some aspects, they only have sunnahs. Some aspects, sunnah, rukun, and wajib. Sorry, rukun, wajib, and sunnah. Yeah. Okay, wudu, it has rukuns and sunnahs. There's nothing that is wajib. If you miss, your wudu is incomplete, but you can substitute for something else. No, there's only six or seven rukuns that I told you, and everything else is sunnah.